In the meanwhile, his disciples prayed unto him, that is Jesus, saying, Master, eat. But he said unto them, I have meat to eat that ye know not of. Therefore said the disciples one to another, Hath any man brought him aught to eat? And Jesus saith unto them, My meat is to do the will of him that sent me, and to finish his work. Say not ye, There are yet 4 months, and then cometh the harvest? Behold, I say unto you, Lift up your eyes, look on the fields, for they are already white unto harvest. As we look at our topic today, and we look at the words of Jesus, as Jesus went throughout the entirety of his ministry, he always found himself on the same mountaintop. He was always looking across the same fields. And every time he looked across those fields, it was always white unto harvest. As we look at our lesson this evening, coming to nearly the close of the lectureship, we've had all of these tremendous lessons that are all dealing with the scope of problems in the first century. And all of these problems dealt with a love issue with God, a love issue even more so with one another. They had problems that dealt with their desire to serve God in the capacity in which he designed for them to serve. But they had problems with looking at themselves more highly than others. They had problems not seeing the need that others had to be served by them. And in the midst of all of those things, those things went undone. When we look at our lives as Christians today, we're going to see how Paul is going to incite us into action to those very same words of the mind of Christ, to look over the fields every day of our lives, to consider ourselves on that same mountaintop every day of our lives, to look over that same field every day of our lives, and to realize that all of them are white unto harvest. They're ready to be harvested. The life of a Christian is not a life of complacency. The life of a Christian is not a spectator sport. If you came here this afternoon to sit back, to relax, and just enjoy listening to somebody speak, you chose the wrong lecture. But if you came here this evening or this afternoon for your mind to be challenged, if you came here this afternoon to realize there is a deficiency in Christianity today, if you have come into this lecture buying into the concept of the theme of the entire week, that there are problems in the 21st century church that are the very same problems that the first century church faced, and the very same solutions that corrected those problems in the first century are the very same corrections that will fix them in the 21st century, then you're in the right place. As we look at the 16th chapter of the book of 1 Corinthians, we see Paul addressing the people with some problems that needed to be corrected. By the way, before I get started, did anyone else not realize that there are more than 4 verses in the 16th chapter of the book of Corinthians? When they said, I want you to preach on generosity and fraternity in the book of 1 Corinthians 16 chapter, I said, where do you get that from? Give. Lay by in store on the first day of every week. I got to preach for 45 minutes on those 4 verses. Lo and behold, I opened up and there's more than 4 verses in chapter 16. As a matter of fact, there just so happens to be enough verses in chapter 16 that I went to Fairfield, Illinois, and I preached Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Monday evening, Tuesday evening, Wednesday evening, Thursday evening, Friday evening, all on chapter 16. I got up there and they said, we don't know how you're going to fill an entire week from one chapter. I got ready to leave. They said, I don't know how you're going to fit all that into one sermon. Well, my objective this afternoon is not to fit all that into one sermon. And my objective this afternoon is not to present to you a lecture. If you want to read a lecture, it's in the book. Read it. Andy said it was halfway decent. If you think he's wrong, take it out on him. He's the editor. But what I want to do is try to pick out some very important points from this chapter that have some very real application in our lives today as Christians. Today there are some things going wrong in the church, and they're the same problems that attacked the church of the first century, and they need to be addressed. But brethren, we don't need new answers. We don't need new solutions. Because the very same solutions that worked then will work today. The problem is we don't want Paul's solution and we don't want God's solution. Because they require expectations of us and sacrifices many times that we're not willing to make. When we look at Christianity, we're going to be talking here in a little bit about the fire and flame that burns inside the Christian. About that flame that is ignited in the soul, in the heart, in the very being of the one who has been converted, born again, risen to a new spiritual life in service to Christ. But we're going to look at what that bushel is that puts it out. And it's none other than fear. Fear that it might spur us to sacrifice more than we're willing to give. We don't face the persecution of the first century, brethren. No one's going to cut your head off if you profess Christ. No one is going to burn you at the stake. Nobody is going to drop you down into a pot of boiling water. But when we realize what true Christianity is about, there are some things we're going to have to give up. And there are some things that we're going to have to commit ourselves to. And there's a very serious question that will have to be answered by the end of this lecture by each and every one of us. And we have an invitation song picked out that's going to help you to decide what the answer to that question is going to be. If you have your Bibles with you, open them to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. As we begin, again, I say we're going to just touch and hit on a couple points in here that I think are very significant to the lives of Christians today. It begins by saying, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come." We're going to hit this real quick. And as a visiting preacher at Hillview Terrace, I can say whatever I want about giving more money. You can't take it out on me. It's a blessing for a preacher to visit somewhere else and preach on giving. But I just want to touch on this for just a moment because I've seen that the people that show up for the West Virginia School Preaching Lectures are giving people. So I know that you don't need to know these things. But there are some things that I want you to consider. This is where we're going to get into some of those questions that we're afraid to answer. When it comes to giving, we look at this passage and it says that on the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God hath prospered him. In the book, I went into a little bit more detail as what that meant. But ultimately, what Paul is saying, as God has led you down a goodly road, as he has provided you a prosperous journey, we want you to repay God for what he has done. What's the road that Paul's talking about? What's the goodly journey that he's referring to? It's your salvation, brethren. It's that eternal journey that leads you to a home in heaven. Ultimately, what we need to be asking ourselves is, what is salvation worth to you? Now, we don't like to hear questions like that, do we? What is your salvation worth to you? Put a dollar amount on it. What is your soul's salvation worth to you? Let me put it in an example. A little boy comes over to your house in the springtime. He says, "I need some money. I want to start saving up some money. I'd like to take on some responsibility. I would like to cut your grass for you all summer. I'll do it every Thursday. What's it worth to you?" And you say, "I'll give you $35 a week to cut that grass." It's a big yard and he's got to push mow it. We'll give him $35. $35, it's worth it to cut my grass. What is it worth? What is your soul worth if you had to put a dollar amount on? Is it worth $35 a week? I mean, I'd throw away $35 a week for someone to cut my grass. But would I put $35 a week into a collection plate? A study was done, a very interesting study, as a matter of fact. A study was done. The average American spends $27. Now, I thought this was a little bit high, but if you start writing things down, you'll know it's not too far off. The average American spends $27 a week on coffee, pop, water, snacks, walk into Walmart, get your groceries, pick up a candy bar on the way out. $27 a week on the way to work, on the way home, on just little things, snacks. Now, I'm not saying take the $27. Take half of that. Take $10. I know that's not half. I'm not that bad in math. Take $10, though. Take $10 and say, I'm going to take that $10 that I throw away a week of the $27, put it in the collection plate, in addition to what I've already committed to giving God each week. You say, brother, you're cutting me tight. Another $10, I don't know if I can fit that into my budget. But I want you to notice, the study wasn't that. The study was this. Within 2 weeks, no, they didn't quit giving. They continued giving that amount. Within 2 weeks, they replaced that $10. They went back to still putting $27 a week into those snacks. Where did it come from? I thought you didn't have the money. I thought it was a tight budget. I don't know, but when it comes to coffee at 5:30 in the morning, I'll find the money for it. When it comes to your soul salvation at 5:30 in the morning, will you find the money for it? Paul says there are some people in dire straits in Jerusalem right now that need your money, your contribution. There are souls that need to be saved, and your money will help accomplish that work. How much is a soul worth to you? How much is a soul worth to you? This is what people don't like about sermons on giving. You have to go home and you have to think, am I giving as God hath prospered me? Am I giving sacrificially? Have I made a determination of what that's going to be? Am I doing it faithfully? And can I do more? Because in all reality, again, what it boils down to is Paul says, as God has led you on a goodly path toward eternity, pay him back. Now, we can get into time and effort and energy and all of those other things. That's outside of the scope of our lesson today, and we don't have time for it. I just want you to think about that, though. When you lay your contribution in the tray, are you representing your appreciation to God with that contribution for leading you down a goodly path to eternity in heaven? As we continue to move on through the passage, it says in verse 3, and I think this is very significant. I think this is good advice for preachers, and I think this is good advice for an eldership or the leadership of a congregation. He says in verse 3, and when I come, whosoever ye shall approve by your letters, them, now notice what he says. He doesn't say, I'm going to come take your money and I'll take it back to Jerusalem for you and say, hey, this came from the church at Corinth. He says in verse 3, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters, them will I send. I will send them to Jerusalem. They will take the money to Jerusalem. And if they want me to go, I'll bring them with me. You know, there are a lot of times there are two mindsets in the leadership of the church, whether it be a preacher or an eldership or a leadership in a church. It's one of two things. Either number one, if you want something done right, do it yourself. Number two is this. I'm a dictator. I'm an elder. It's up to everyone else's responsibility to do what I tell them to do. That's not how the church operates. Elders, preachers are leaders in the church. People follow by example. Paul understood a few things in saying this. Number one, you pick some people that need to go down there. Why? A couple different reasons. One, I want you to be involved in your contribution. But secondly, imagine the effect that it has on an individual. All right, we collect all of this money and we're going to take it to this city that needs the financial support, and these individuals take it down and they see the end result of what is happening with their money. One of the gravest mistakes in the church as far as contribution is concerned, we want people to give more, but we don't give them a reason to. Let them see where the money is going, but make them a part of the work. Paul didn't say, I'll take care of that for you, it's on the way. He said, send your own people, and if they want to accompany me, they can come with me, and I'll go with them and take that down there. Brethren, we've got to get people involved in the church. The work of the church is not up to the preacher. The work of the church is not up to the elders. But elders and preachers need to be leaders. They need to say, this is what we want to do. This is how we want to accomplish it. Now come with us and let's do it together. Because the brethren will not be active if, number one, they do not have a leader. Sheep will not follow if there is no leader. number two is this. If you take it upon yourself to do it yourself and they don't have an opportunity to be involved, they don't care. And we lose the congregation. As it continues on, we drop down through the passage. He says, "Now I'll come to you when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia." Verse 6, "And it may be that I will abide, yea, in winter with you, that ye might bring me on my journey whithersoever I go. For I will not see you now, by the way, but I trust to tarry a while if you, if the Lord permit." Notice what he's saying. "I'd really like to come stay with you for a while, but right now I don't have adequate time to do so." We understand why after this week, right? With all of the problems of the church, this wasn't going to be a weekend fix. Paul understood with a great deal of instruction, this was going to take time, patience, effort, diligence, long-suffering. He said, "When I have the time to spend with you and tarry with you through all of this process, that's when I'm going to come." And I hope that it'll be an encouragement to them. But notice what he says, and this is where we get into a next great point in this passage. "But I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost, for a great door and effectual is open unto me, and there are many adversaries." This is a powerful verse for a lot of different reasons. Number one, he says there is a great door. It's an enormous door, or maybe it's a lot of doors. The word also has the connotation that it is a powerful door. It also carries with it the connotation that it is a powerful thing, a blessing from God. Boy, that opens up a whole new series of lessons as far as personal evangelism, doesn't it? He says there is a great opportunity for me there. It is an effective opportunity, an opportunity in which there will yield results. But notice what he says about it. He's excited about this. Paul has something wrong with him. He says, "I can't wait to get to Ephesus. There's a great opportunity filled with adversary." That's what he says. There is a great... Now, this is a man that's been shipwrecked. This is a man that's been stoned and left for dead. This is a man that's been beaten and run out of town. He said, "There is a great open door, an effective work that can be done in Ephesus, and there are people waiting to kill me. I can't wait to get there." Notice the idea behind adversary is someone who stands against you. Notice Paul says these are the most effective types of doors. Does that make sense? That people that stand strongly against you can be the most effective opportunity for evangelistic work. Jesus said it did. Because in the book of Revelation, when Jesus was dealing with the churches, you remember he spoke of one of them that was neither hot nor cold, but they were lukewarm. Remember what he said about that church? "I would that you were either hot or what? Or cold." What do you mean, either hot or cold? Either saved or lost? You'd rather them be lost? No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying if you're hot, you're on fire for God, you're saved. He's saying if you're lukewarm, I spew you out of my mouth because you make me sick. You make me nauseous. But he says if you're cold, you can be converted. You see what Paul saw? He saw opportunity in adversaries. When's the last time that we looked at adversary, confrontation, as the most effective and powerful opportunity for evangelistic work? I don't remember. Because what we like to embrace is the easy work. We like to try to smooth somebody over and get them in the church and let them come for a year, 2 years, and after that, maybe we'll think about sitting down. Since now they've heard the gospel for so long, maybe we'll have an in-home Bible study, but we don't want to bring up too much at once. We want to let them take their time, digest it easily, and hope that in the process of the 7 years that it takes for us to muster up the courage and talk to somebody that's already going to church, they might get baptized. But what about our children? What about our children? We don't preach the gospel to our children. We don't make them go to worship services. We don't teach them the importance and the priority of worship services over sports and over other extracurricular activities. Because we don't want to force religious thought upon. We want them to grow up and make their own decision on whether or not they want to serve God. Isn't that the responsible thing to do? That's not what God said to do. If I remember right, God said, don't give your kids the choice. That's what God said concerning the matter. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, it is recorded, now these are the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God commanded to teach you that ye might do them in the land whither you go to possess it. Now notice what it says. That thou mightest fear the Lord thy God to keep all of his statutes and commandments which I command thee, thou, thy sons, and thy sons' sons all the days of their life. Where is the option? Where do we get to choose whether or not you have a right of religious freedom in my home? You don't. And the problem is we're giving our children the opportunity to make that decision for themselves today. Let me drop down a few more verses. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thine soul, with all thy mind. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. What's he mean by in your heart? He means every aspect of your life is consumed in these words. So he goes on to say, as a result, thou shalt teach them. If it doesn't offend them, you should teach that to your children. And if you don't think that they're ready, wait a few more years. And if they really kick against it, I mean, after all, as teenagers, they need their freedom, they need their space. Just give them some time, they'll come around. And when all of that's said and done, if you have opportunity and there's some free time, ask them if they'll join you Sunday morning at worship services. Does that sound familiar to any of you? No, what he said is, thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up, thou shalt bind them. Bind them. Do you know what that word means? To be bound, to be tied up. There is no freedom in binding. When you bind someone together, if you bind their hands together, they cannot move. They cannot free themselves. They are forced unto bondage. Bind them. Our children need bound, brethren. There's a reason why they're children. They don't have the ability to make good decisions. Make them for them. We have three generations of children and adults. Adults that are asking themselves, why are my children not faithful members of the body of Christ? It's because Sunday morning, as soon as we finish communion, you're leaving church and taking them to ball practice. It's because Sunday evening, the basketball game went over a little bit late and you decided to skip Sunday evening services. It's because Wednesday there was band practice and they needed to be at band practice or they weren't allowed to perform at the game, so they skipped Wednesday evening Bible study. You tell me, when is there room to teach your children that God is a priority if He is not the priority? But we don't want to look at ourselves to blame for that, do we? Certainly there's another. It's the devil. The devil is so active today, so much more active than he was when I was a child. No, he's not. You want to know what the problem is? There's no adversary. That's the problem. Satan busted his tail in to destroy the Word of God. It never happened. He tried to persecute the Christians of the first century. He lit them up as torches, and they were still faithful. As we move on through history, they were beheaded. They were taken in the Colosseums and fed to lions. They tried to destroy them. There were those throughout time that said, I'll destroy the Bible. I'll remove it from the face of the earth. It didn't work. Satan had exhausted himself in destroying Christianity. So he took a step back and said, I'm not going to do anything. And it worked. It worked. How many of you would lose your job? I'm talking about get fired right now if you mention Christ in the workplace. But there is an unspoken law, right? That you can't talk about religion or politics in workplace. And we follow it. How many of us sit down still yet and have Bible studies in our homes for our children? Not yet. It's not a law yet. Oh, there have been some that have been tried for taking a Bible to school or praying or teaching somebody about the gospel. But we're not going to jail yet over it. But there's no persecution. There's no adversary. And Satan figured something out. You'll fall by the wayside without one. And he doesn't have to do a thing. Because as Christians, we're striving so hard to be like the rest of the world that we're losing ourselves. Somebody said yesterday morning, I don't remember who said it in their lecture, the church won't be destroyed from the outside. It'll implode. It is. Right now, it's imploding. Do you not see a generation gap here this evening? Look around. Go ahead. Don't look at me. Look around. Do you not see a generation gap? I'm not talking about one. I'm talking about three generations. They're gone. They're not here. Go to Friday night sing. They're not there. They're not here. They're not at gospel meetings. They're not at services on Wednesday night. They're not at services on Sunday night. Why not? Because it is more important that our children fit in the world. It's more important that our teenage daughters wear exotic lingerie to the prom, into a dark atmosphere in which they play music that is sexually oriented, and she is embraced by a boy that has the same intentions. And for some reason, we lie to ourselves and say, well, it's not like anything's going to happen. That stuff doesn't really go on. Seriously. We're more determined that our kids are not made fun of because they don't show up to ball practice on Wednesday night. We're more concerned that our kids might be made fun of if they have to leave the game early Sunday afternoon to get to services. We're more concerned about how it may affect our children to not be of the world. And therefore, we allow them to become part of the world. And we don't understand why we have three generations missing in this building. We don't understand why the attendance is falling and churches are closing their doors. It's because of this, brethren. There's an adversary. Go home and look in the mirror and you will have found it. Complacency is destroying the church. Refusing to raise our children with a God-like and a Christ-like priority is destroying the church. We have opportunity for the greatest evangelistic work in our home. It's not happening. Why? Because we'll be put to death if we don't? No, because nothing will happen if we don't. Do you see where I'm coming from now? Satan's greatest advantage over us is that he's going to leave us alone. And it's worked. And people are falling out of the church by the thousands. And we don't know what to do. Oh, we know what to do. Vote. Vote in this next election. If we can get a godly president, a Christian president in office, it'll change everything. Didn't you realize that? If we can get a Christian president in office... Do you remember what it looked like when Christianity became a state government religion? Do you remember what happened when that went around? Still yet, we continue to pray that we'll have a Christian president. While you're praying that you might one day get a Christian president and you're waiting for that day to get active, I hope that the few of us that still care can save your children's souls before they go to hell for all eternity. Brethren, we're looking for everyone else to do our work, and we're not doing it ourselves. Paul said, I see adversary, and I can't wait to get there, because in adversary, I will find souls that can be saved. And that's the attitude that we need to have. We need to see adversary. We need to go out and find souls that need saved. We've got to reach them, brethren. And the only way that we can do that is to get up off of our pews and do it every single day. Moving on very quickly in the time that we have left. As we drop down, I want to drop down a few more passages or a few more verses. Verse 13, watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit ye like men, be strong, let all your things be done with love. I think it's very important in the church today that we understand all things be done in love. But do you know you can rebuke with love? We do realize that we can still rebuke and teach with love, right? See, there's a bridge, a gap somewhere that happened where we said either you're a member of the body of Christ or you're going to go to hell. And then we just went to the complete opposite side and said, well, everybody's going to heaven. Well, we know that's not true. But we're not doing anything to fix it. This is what happened. Several years ago, there was this evangelistic effort that said, if you're not a member of the Church of Christ, you're going to go to hell. And then Christians found that people didn't like us anymore because we said that. So instead of correcting that and trying to use maybe a little bit more love and compassion in teaching them, we just stay home because they know they don't want to hear anything from us. We're afraid to death that if we walk up to their door, they say, we don't want to talk to you. So we don't. And there again, the adversary is that there is no adversary. We just sit at home and we're content, hoping that we can save ourselves. Did you realize there's a difference between staying out of hell and making it to heaven? If you do no wrong, you may think that you're not going to go to hell. But if all you're doing is no wrong, then you're not doing any good. And if you're not doing any good, then you're not going to make it to heaven. Doing no wrong is a lukewarm church that gets spewed out by Christ. Doing good is a church that is working, that is always finding some way to reach out to people, to affect them, and to save the souls of mankind. As we move on down, it says, I beseech you, brethren, you know the house of Stephanas, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. That may be my favorite passage in the Bible. They have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. Some of your passages read that they have appointed themselves. I don't think that's as cool as addicted. I think addicted is way cooler. And since it's in the King James translation, it's authorized. So that's what we're going to use, is addicted. But seriously, in all reality, even if you say they appointed themselves, what they're saying is they took it upon themselves to make it their responsibility to serve the brethren. That's Christianity. What did Jesus say was the greatest commandment? Love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart, soul, strength, mind. And then beyond that, he said the second is likened to it. What was it? Love your neighbor as yourself. Two commandments. How do we show God that we love him? John reveals to us in John's first epistle, chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. We show God that we love him. How? By loving the brethren, loving one another. That's how we do it. If we don't love the brethren, we do not love God. If a man says he loves God and he hates his brother, he's a what? He's a liar. He's the same as a murderer. We have to love the brethren. That's where it starts. If you want to show God you love him, love the brethren. He said, look at the house of Stephanas. They are the first fruits. You know, in the idea of first fruits are two different connotations. Either number one, they were the beginning of the establishment of the church, or number two, they were the most magnificent Christians in Corinth. They might be both. They might be both because, number one, maybe they were the establishment of the church in Corinth. But number two, because they were addicted to the service of the brethren, they were great. They were great. Brethren, we have to addict ourselves to the service of one another. When is the last time that you burned to see one another? I love the West Virginia School of Preaching Lectureship. I love being here. Almost all of you have played a tremendous role in my life as a Christian from the time that I was this big all the way up to where I am now. And from when I was this big to this big. But irregardless, when you look at it, I look back, I see, where's he at? Albert Farley. I remember he got me a Bible when I was at church camp one year and wrote this note in. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. I still have that paper-bound Bible that you gave me at church camp when I was just a young child. I couldn't have been any more than 10 years old. I looked through this entire auditorium. There are people here that have made an enormous impact in my life as a gospel preacher. Without my mother and father, I wouldn't be here. Without Denver Cooper, I'd have never come to the school of preaching. When I look at in my family, my grandfather was a preacher. Frank is my uncle. You may not have known that. You do now. He's my great uncle. That's just because I love you more, Frank. It's not because you're that much older. He is my great uncle. I have a great legacy of preaching in my family. I look at Emmanuel and his wife, Andy, Terry, all of you, faces that I've known throughout my whole life. And as I continue to move from area to area, I'm at Reader now. Wayne and Brenda are here. They are tremendous, tremendous supporters and encouragers of me. Brethren, they are addicted to the work, to the service of the brethren. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about addicted. Have you ever started a fire Have you ever noticed how quickly a fire spreads? Let me, in the time I have left, I just want to tell you this story real quick. I was working at a farm taking care of some horses and all the property. And there were some brush piles on the outside of the wood line that they wanted burned because they wanted to be able to take their horses down in the wood line. And I didn't really want to move the brush piles out from in between the trees, so I thought I would burn them slowly and everything would be okay. So I put some diesel fuel, by the way, don't use diesel if you want it to burn slowly. I put some diesel fuel on that brush pile. And I lit a match, and it was hot. I mean super hot. And I was okay for about the first 3 seconds. But at 5, it had exploded. That was the gasoline part of the diesel. It had exploded. And next thing you know, there are trees, big trees, and the fire is going up the trees. And I'm looking around, and now they're like 6 trees on fire. The whole woods are on fire. Not just my brush pile. The woods are on fire. These people are millionaires. They will sue me for all the money that I will never have. Their forest is on fire. So like a monkey, I take my shirt off, and I'm climbing up trees, beating them with a shirt, trying to get the fire out. There is something I realized about fire. It spreads quickly. Jeremiah said that the Lord wanted me to go out and to preach to the people, and I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it, but the message of God was so strong inside me, it was like a fire in my bones, and I was weary. It wore me out trying to contain it. I was weary trying to contain that fire. It wore him out, so what did he do? He went out and he preached the gospel, and the fire spread. Brethren, Jesus said that we are a light. We are that flame. You remember that song, "It Only Takes a Spark to Get a Fire Going"? Here's the problem in the church today, brethren. When you are baptized, not just soaked in water, but baptized into Christ, and you are raised a new creature, you are now a flame. And you can do one of two things with that flame. You can fan it and cause a forest fire. Or you can allow it to be hid under a bushel. I remember as a kid, I knew better than to hide that flame under a bushel. But for some reason, being lost in translation, when we become adults, we hide that flame under a bushel. You know how I know that? Because there are 3 generations of people missing here today. That's how I know that. We're not preaching the gospel. We're not going from door to door. We're not saving our children. We're not saving our neighbors. We're not saving our family. And as a result, we have half the people here that we ought to have. Maybe 1/4 the people here that we ought to have. Brethren, you have a choice today. You can allow yourselves to become on fire for Christ. This is why we don't, though. When I lit that fire, I thought I could keep it under control. I realized I couldn't. So I don't burn brush fires anymore. Because I'm afraid of them. And sometimes as Christians, we're afraid of what might happen when we burn out of control. Because when we understand what it means to truly serve Christ, Paul said, "For me, to die is gain, but to live is what? Is Christ." When Paul said, "I want you to be followers of me, imitators of me," he wasn't being self-righteous because he didn't exist. He said, "I have been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, it is not I that lives, but who? Christ that lives in me." When Paul spoke, he spoke the words of Christ. When Paul performed actions, he performed the actions of Christ. When he said, "Be followers of me," he was saying, "Be followers of Christ." He was on fire. It took him all over the world. It caused him to be persecuted. But look at how many souls were saved because of the work of that one man, that one individual, who allowed that flame that's inside of all of us, brethren. You've been there and you felt it when you come up out of that water. I know you felt it if you knew what you were doing. Because for the first time, the burden of the sins of your life were lifted. The flame's there. Do you fan the flame? Or do you hide it under a bushel? Very quickly, I want to go over one thing and leave you with a story. What do I have? 2 minutes? I think about 2 minutes. Struggling here. Okay. As we look at the close of the chapter, I'm not even going to get to the close of the chapter. I'm not going to lie to you. As we drop down a couple verses, he says, "I am glad of the coming of Stephanus and Fortunatus and Achaicus, For that which was lacking on your part, they have supplied. For they have refreshed my spirit. I want to just spend a couple minutes on that and then close with an illustration. No one in this life will be discouraged more often than a preacher. I'm not saying it because I'm a preacher, and I'm not saying it because I want sympathy. I'm saying it because of this. Every day we're striving to see results of the work that we do, the labors. And it's hard work. It's exhausting, mentally, physically, spiritually. And just as Paul understood that there were times in his life he needed refreshed, preachers need refreshed. Those of you that are students at the school preaching right now, enjoy this, because one thing you will not get to do when you become a preacher is hear other preachers, because you're preaching, except for opportunities like this. But you will be beat down on a daily basis. You will be discouraged with leadership troubles. You will be discouraged with trying to get membership to be active. You will be discouraged when numbers are not where you think they ought to be. You will be discouraged when people aren't being baptized the way that they ought to be. You will be discouraged when you just can't muster up the Bible studies like you really thought you envisioned you were going to be able to have. And sometimes you just need refreshed. I had an opportunity to go to Fairfield, Illinois. It was so refreshing to get out there with another group of people, to have an opportunity to preach to them the gospel and to see that it was just so readily welcomed. They were so kind and generous. It was a tremendous opportunity for me. I have opportunities. I've always, in times past, had opportunities to be up here. It's refreshing. I have opportunities to go to Friday Night Sings with my father. That is refreshing. I speak about scriptures with my mother on the phone. That is refreshing. Brethren, there are times that you work and you work and you work and you need refresh. Paul said, when you sent these men down to me, it was as if you took all of the load of my burden of work off of me, and I didn't have to bear it. You have refreshed my soul and my spirit. It's kind of like when you're working, you're up on your feet all day long from 5 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night. Your shoes, your feet are in boots with socks on. And you sit down when you get home and you take your boots off and you take your socks off. And the first breath of fresh air that your toes have felt for over 14 hours. Isn't that refreshing? Doesn't that feel great? That's what Paul's talking about. For days and days on end, you're just wore out. You're beat up. You're struggling, and you're trying to find something good in all of it. Preachers need you. Paul needed those brethren to refresh him. You know, your body can only take so much. Your heart can only take so much. Your mind can only take so much before you break down and you fall apart. Preachers need the brethren to refresh them, to bring back their spirits, to be an encouragement to them, and to lift them up. I want to close with this last concept that kind of ties in with the whole thing. Brethren, as you look through the lecture, you'll be able to see Paul's work individually with all of these people. And I'm sorry that we didn't have time to cover those things, but I hope the lecture nonetheless has still been profitable to you. But as we close this, and I offer an invitation, but I also want to tie in a few things. Paul understood something when he wrote a letter to the Corinthians. First and foremost, we serve God. We serve God by serving one another. And in serving one another, we have a responsibility to take the message of the gospel out into the world. No, that's not up to the preacher, because that's what you pay him for. You pay him to equip you to go out into the world and do that. We have a responsibility. When you look at that flame that's inside you, decide what you want to do with that flame. Being addicted to the service of the saints is full-time work. Not full-time like quit your job, full-time like every day. Find some way to become addicted to the work of the saints, the service of the saints. because that's Christianity. As you walk out of here, you can walk out of here making one of two decisions. You can be lukewarm. You can't be cold. You can't be cold if you're Christians here today. You can't be cold. You're believers. I am speaking to believers, right? Shake your heads. Yes. So you're either hot or you're lukewarm. And you know what you are. Are you hot or are you lukewarm? Are you an uncontrollable fire for Christ? Or are you an ember that's been hid underneath a bushel? Let me tell you something. A little ember under a bushel is not lost of hope. I share with you an illustration that I've used one other time, and that I leave the lesson with you. There's a song that we sing, "You Never Mentioned Him to Me." Ever heard that? It's a very sobering song. Sometimes I think we don't sing the song because it is sobering, and it makes us feel guilty. Somewhere in every opportunity of our life, we have an opportunity to touch the lives of those that are around us. We have an opportunity to save souls every day if we will let our light so shine. But because there is no adversary and we're complacent and content with being just like the rest of the world, we lose those opportunities by letting them pass by. It's a burden. And it's a burden that you will bear the rest of your life. In 2002, I was deployed. And during that time, I dealt with a lot of individuals that were vulnerable, that needed something to believe in because they were afraid they were going to lose it all. There was a great door and effectual opportunity available to me. And I passed it by. I passed that by because I was worried about taking care of myself, and because I wasn't so sure that it was, well, I don't have a good answer for it. Why don't we tell people about Christ? I guess I wasn't convicted. Three of my friends that I was deployed with died within a month after we got back. Not once did I mention to them the gospel of Christ. One of my friends accidentally shot himself. A handgun he was cleaning went off in a kitchen sink. Bullet entered in under his armpit, and he bled to death within 30 seconds. I went to his funeral, and I stood over his coffin. And every day, haunted by the words, "You never mentioned him to me." You carry those burdens forever. You don't get to let them go. There's not a season of refreshing for souls that are not saved because you don't have the courage to let your light so shine. So because of this man, 7 years ago, I decided that every day I would make up for that. Because of the support of all of you for the last 7 years, every day I decided I would make up for that. And I refuse to hide that light under a bushel again. I refuse to stand over one more coffin and be haunted by those words, "You never mentioned him to me." You have a decision right now. We're going to sing a song, and God is going to search your hearts. I pray that you search your hearts as well. It's time that we apply a first century solution to a 21st century problem. It's time for us to stand up and fight. It's time for us to be the Christians we ought to be. It's time for us to quit waiting for a president to bring Christianity back to a country and start with our children and save them. For the love of God, save your children. Save your neighbors and your best friends. Save your families. Save the church. Save souls. brethren, right now you are all standing on the same mountaintop looking over the same field. But what do you see? Do you see, wait 4 more months and it'll be ready? Or do you see that it's white and ready for harvest? The choice is a choice that you have to make right now, for every day, for the rest of your life. We don't want to close this lecture without offering an invitation to any who might be here and outside of Christ. I know these opportunities don't really lend themselves to those that are outside of Christ, but if you are here this evening and outside of Christ, by no means have the faithful brethren that have preached throughout this entire week shunned to reveal the faithful gospel of Christ. If you're here and you believe in God and Christ Jesus as His Son, then put Him on as your Savior. Allow that flame to burn within you uncontrollably and live a faithful life in service to God. But if you're here this afternoon, brethren, and you find yourself in a place of lukewarm, you're in no greater condition than somebody that's outside of the body of Christ. As a matter of fact, you're in worse condition because you sit there and you think that you're okay. And you think that you've earned your way to heaven. And God will give you what you deserve on Judgment Day. Lo and behold, it might not be what we expect. If you're here this evening and you need to make some changes in your life. If you're here this evening and you need to make a light shine. If you're here this evening and a light that you've been hiding under a bushel needs to be fanned. And a flame needs to be ignited. So that you may burn out of control, then you make that decision to do so today. If you have a need outside of that that requires the prayers and the encouragement of the church, examine your soul, your heart, and respond in the invitation the way you see fit as we stand and sing.